there were other people in equal positions and plants around the state. So I'm saying it was not just a group of people opposing racism, but people building power strategically. And there's no way that the textile industry is not implicated in this. But we still think that North Carolina has moved. It is not the worst state in the South. It has always tended to be somewhere in the middle, in the sense that it was the last out of the Union and close to the first back in the Union in the Civil War. So it always has had that kind of
Reverend Nelson, we have to wrap up the show, but I wanted to just say one thing. In the clip we played, the Klansman or Nazi used the N-word, and we asked you, should we repeat that? You said yes. We have 10 seconds. Why?
Because the truth matters, Amy.
It's as simple as that. People need to know the truth of our history. And that word, which is very derogatory, is part of that history. And it is that simple.
We want to thank you both for being with us, Reverend Nelson Johnson and Joyce Johnson, survivors of the 1979 Greensboro Massacre, co-founders of the Greensboro Truth and Reconciliation Commission, and now co-executive directors of the beloved Community Center of Greensboro, North Carolina. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan
Gonzalez. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available on our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closures of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Program Advisory Committee meets on the second Tuesday of the month at 6 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on this fall membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News, coronavirus testing in Oregon is set to increase as the state receives thousands of tests set to last through the year's end. Murderer and ex-police officer Derek Chauvin is out of jail on a $1 million bond, and the Department of Homeland Security confirms what many of us already know, that white supremacists are the nation's greatest terror threat. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, October 7th, 2020. KBOO is currently in our membership drive, and we'd like to urge you to become a member by going online to kboo.fm/give. I'm Althea Billings. On Wednesday, the Oregon Health Authority reported 305 new cases of COVID-19, bringing the state's total number of confirmed and presumptive cases up to 35,645. Oregon health officials also reported 2 new deaths, raising the state's death toll up to 583. Lane County had the highest number of new cases on Wednesday with 53, followed by Multnomah County with 43. In the United States, over 7.5 million people have contracted the coronavirus, and at least 211,000 people have died. Worldwide, 36 million people have been infected with coronavirus, and over 1 million people have died. Oregon's coronavirus testing capabilities are about to grow substantially, as the state will receive enough testing kits to perform double the amount of tests as before. Through December, Oregon will receive enough rapid antigen testing kits to do 80,000 tests per week, more than double the state's current capacity for testing. The Oregon Health Authority says the increase in testing will help to control the spread of COVID-19, aid in knowing who should quarantine, and go a long way as far as contact tracing goes. The state hopes the dramatic increase in testing capabilities will bring COVID-19 cases down and eventually allow schools to reopen. Patrick Allen is the director of the Oregon Health Authority. He's noted that there simply aren't enough tests to screen students regularly, and as a result, the only way to ensure COVID-19 isn't passed around in schools is to reduce the amount of undetected cases in the community at large. Allen worries that more negative tests may give people a false sense of security. So, just as a reminder, the best way to prevent the spread of COVID-19 is still to wear a mask, wash your hands, and socially distance. Protesters gathered yesterday near the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement Facility in South Portland for the 121st night of demonstrations against police brutality. Federal officers quickly declared an unlawful assembly on the approximately 50 protesters who arrived to the ICE building around 10 p.m. last night. Federal officers responded with an enormous show of force, using copious amounts of noxious gas, impact munitions, and flashbangs to disperse the protesters. Residents in the area were affected by the gas. One individual even called the police on the police, saying she couldn't breathe. She later confronted the Portland Police Bureau officers outside her building, who told her the federal officers were the ones responsible for the gas. Portland police seemed to coordinate with the federal officers last night, and PPB reported in a press release that the crowd threw rocks at them. Four people were arrested. The police officer facing charges over the murder of George Floyd has been released on a $1 million bond today. Derek Chauvin, who kneeled on Floyd's neck until he died, was released from the Oak Park Heights Correctional Facility near Minneapolis at around 11:30 a.m. today. His next court date is set for March 8, 2021. So far, it's not clear who paid the bail bond company or how much. Minnesota law allows bonds people to charge a maximum of 10% of the bail amount, in this case, $100,000. The Minnesota Police and Peace Officers Association, which does have a legal defense fund, did not put up the money, according to a spokesperson. Chauvin faces counts of second-degree murder, third-degree murder, and second-degree manslaughter in the May 25th killing of George Floyd. Video captured of the murder shows Chauvin kneeling on Floyd's neck for nearly 9 minutes as Floyd tries to tell him that he cannot breathe. Chauvin and the three other officers involved in the murder have been fired, and the other officers also face charges that include aiding and abetting second-degree murder. White supremacist groups remain the deadliest terror threat to the United States, according to the first-ever Homeland Threat Assessment released by the Department of Homeland Security. The report details that since 2018, white supremacists have perpetuated more lethal attacks in the U.S. than any other domestic extremist movement. The report also says white supremacists have demonstrated a, quote, long-standing intent to target racial and religious minorities, members of the LGBTQ plus community, and people who they believe promote multiculturalism and globalization. Tonight is the vice presidential candidate debate between Senator Kamala Harris and current Vice President Mike Pence. With more on that story and others, we go to Lily Bolke with 2020 Talks.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 elections in uncharted territory.
This is probably the most important vice presidential debate of the modern era, I would say, because of the age of both Donald Trump and Joe Biden. Joe Biden being 77, Donald Trump is 74. Donald Trump now had this bombshell with this announcement of having had COVID.
University of Florida professor Sharon Austin predicts higher ratings than usual for tonight's vice presidential debate between current VP Mike Pence and Democratic Senator Kamala Harris.
Both of them are going to have to sort of speak for their running mate, but they also are going to have to speak for themselves and convince the American public that if I had to step into the presidency today, would I be able to do it?
Following the news that the president might have been contagious when he debated Biden, the candidates will be more than 12 feet apart with plexiglass dividers. Pence's campaign says dividers aren't necessary. The added precaution isn't the only lesson Glenda Carr hopes the candidates take from last week's debate. Carr is from Higher Heights, which promotes Black women in politics.
People want to hear a good, robust debate, but being able to create some space so that voters who are undecided actually have the ability to hear both campaigns make their pitch.
Yesterday, Trump ordered Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin to stop negotiating another round of economic relief until, quote, after the election, when immediately after I win, we will pass a major stimulus bill. He claims House Democrats only want to, quote, bail out poorly run, high-crime Democrat states. In Gettysburg, former Vice President Joe Biden doubled down on his message of unity.
We paid a high price for allowing the deep divisions in this country to impact on how we deal with the coronavirus.
And former First Lady Michelle Obama posted a personal 24-minute video of what she called her closing argument for Biden, appealing to voters across class, color, and age.
So we can expect that this election will be won by the slimmest of margins, just like 4 years ago. A handful of votes per precinct in Pennsylvania or Arizona or Wisconsin or Florida or anywhere else will make all the difference.
In Florida, the voter registration deadline was extended a day after the state's website crashed Monday. The site was seeing more than a million requests per hour. Voting advocates say more time is still needed. Pennsylvania's voter services website was also down last weekend, but voters there still have 2 weeks to register. Many local election officials are working heroically under difficult conditions to ensure smooth and COVID-safe processes. Federal officials from multiple branches came out yesterday in support. Here's Chris Krebs, the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency Director.
We're going to remain on the lookout for any threats and stand with our election partners to give them all the support they need at this critical time. But you can play a role too by being a prepared, participating, and patient voter.
From Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Lily Bolke. Thanks for listening at pacificanetwork.org and publicnewsservice.org.
How will votes in this fall's presidential election be counted? It's more complicated than you may think. Suzanne Potter with the Public News Service has more on that story.
The results in the presidential election will be significantly delayed, and experts say there are multiple scenarios where the election could end up in the courts or in the House of Representatives. Due to the pandemic, tens of millions of Americans have chosen to vote by mail, which will slow down the state-by-state count. Professor Capri Cafaro with American University says immediate results are unlikely.
So I think people can expect not just an election night, but an election week. And, you know, if things get close, I guess that's where the real issues begin.
Allegations of fraud and protracted recounts could wind up at the U.S. Supreme Court, which only has 8 justices after the death of Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Republicans are vowing to confirm President Donald Trump's nominee ASAP. If there is a tie in the Electoral College, the law sends the decision to the U.S. House of Representatives. Cafaro warns that this could favor Trump, even though Democrats control the House. That's because each state delegation only gets one vote, and there are more states controlled by Republicans than by Democrats.
The thing is, I believe this would be after the next Congress is sworn in, so Speaker Pelosi is putting a lot of pressure trying to pick up seats for that purpose as well all across the country.
The Electoral College votes on December 14th. A recent article in The Atlantic alleged that the Trump campaign has discussed with Pennsylvania Republican Party leaders the possibility of declaring the election a fraud, bypassing the results, and encouraging state legislatures in Republican-controlled states to appoint their own slate of electors. The Constitution allows states wide latitude to circumvent the usual process, but Cafaro thinks it is highly unlikely because the backlash would be huge.
Somehow there'd have to be some kind of a mutiny to say we refuse to allow the Democratic electors for Joe Biden to come into the chamber and sign the book. I mean, I guess, but I mean, that's really far-fetched.
Trump has warned that the large number of mail-in ballots raises the risk of fraud. However, past all-mail elections have shown very, very few cases of people committing felony mail fraud by altering or destroying ballots. Support for this reporting was provided by the Carnegie Corporation of New York. For Public News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
October is National Disability Employment Awareness Month, and advocacy groups agree it's a good opportunity to close the hiring gap. Mike Moen has the story.
For many, working from home has become the new norm during the pandemic. As companies continue to invest in this approach, people living with disabilities say it's time for businesses to consider them an equal part of the workforce. October is National Disability Employment Awareness Month, and advocacy groups agree it's a good opportunity to close the hiring gap. According to the Brookings Institution, only 4 in 10 working-age adults with disabilities in the U.S. are employed. Brooke Lovelace of the Iowa Developmental Disabilities Council is concerned the coronavirus is widening that gap.
Folks with disabilities, some of them have had to stay home because they feel that they are at risk and cannot participate in their employment or cannot participate in the workforce.
At the same time, she says these workers have long called for companies to provide more accommodations for working from home. As a result of the health crisis, technology is proving that remote jobs can be done in a variety of fields, And Lovelace says businesses should make sure they're truly being inclusive in their hiring. In addition to hiring practices, Lovelace says this month is a good reminder for companies to ensure that their buildings have the necessary accommodations for all people living with disabilities.
It's not just for employers, but it's just to make it more inclusive for your customers and for the community.
The Bureau of Labor Statistics says the latest jobless rate for workers with disabilities is higher than 14%, compared to an overall unemployment rate of around 8%. And in an annual report that tracks state-by-state rankings, Iowa is 13th in the nation for hiring people with disabilities. Mike Moen, Public News Service.
You are listening to a fall membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News. We'd like to remind you that you can renew your KBOO membership or become a member at any time during this program by going online to kboo.fm/give. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth look at the effects of hazardous chemicals used by police organizations in Portland. At 5:45, we'll hear news from the Boo, then at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be partly cloudy with a low of 56. Tomorrow we'll see cloudy skies again with a high of 66. Today in history, in 1967, writer, civil rights activist, and professor Michelle Alexander was born. She is best known for her work, The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness. The quote of the day is from that book, where Alexander writes, quote, "The fact that more than half of the young black men in any large American city are currently under the control of the criminal justice system or saddled with criminal records is not, as many argue, just a symptom of poverty or poor choices, but rather evidence of a new racial caste system at work." Wheatgrass, the kind that hibernates during the winter and comes back in the spring, could be the key to helping farmers adapt to climate change. Dr. Anthony Leisowitz has more on that story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Leisowitz, and this is Climate Connections. As the weather gets colder, Carmen Fernholz of Minnesota enjoys looking out at his fields of kernza. This wheatgrass is a perennial, which means it overwinters and comes back in spring.
It's so nice to see some green fields late into November and December and early again in March and April.
Kernza grows chest high, with roots that can extend nearly 10 feet below ground. So over time, it helps build soil carbon, improve soil health, and reduce runoff.
We look at increased rains that we're getting even in western Minnesota. We got a way to take care of that extra precipitation all the better.
And kernza can provide farmers with two crops, forage for livestock, and a grain that can be used in cereal and other foods. So it's promising, but new. Fernholz is growing a small amount and giving feedback to researchers. He says his main concern is figuring out how to keep yields up over time. But he says growing kernza for a few years between other crops will improve his soil.
And so by utilizing the kernza, it's just going to make that field much better for my major revenue crops of corn and soybeans.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
The digital divide is evident on tribal lands, where it's often unaffordable or even impossible to get internet service. With that story and more, we turn to Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. America's digital divide is especially stark on reservations, where broadband is often unaffordable or just not available. Federal pandemic relief money is providing an opportunity to narrow the divide. Aaron Bolton reports.
On top of a small mountain on the Flathead Indian Reservation in western Montana sits a brand new 180-foot cell tower. Confederated Salish and Kootenai Tribes Infrastructure Administrator Chuck Reese says in the coming months it will help broadcast wireless high-speed internet over roughly 80% of the reservation.
To give you an idea, we're bringing fiber optic right in here too, all the way up this mountain. I mean, this is first-class connectivity.
Nearly half of local residents here have no access to high-speed internet. Reese says this change will now allow them to take advantage of online education and telehealth and give tribal police connectivity right in their cars. In February, the Federal Communications Commission offered free broadband wireless spectrum capable of broadcasting high-speed wireless internet to tribes. Initially, not many applied because
to make the equipment on those towers really robust, you need a healthy amount of power to them and strong fiber.
Jeff Blackwell is with Amerind Risk Management, a native-owned insurance company that helps tribes improve digital access. Within 5 years, tribes have to pay to build towers and run fiber optic cable and other utilities to actually make these wireless networks a reality. Each project could cost hundreds of thousands to millions of dollars. After Congress passed $8 billion in federal coronavirus relief funding for tribes in late March, tribes submitted more than 400 applications for the free wireless spectrum.
It's important they took this step for broadband purposes, but also utilizing a mechanism that recognizes that placing tribal nations themselves in the center of the regulatory process has a chance of significant success.
However, Blackwell says many tribal lands weren't included and that the FCC will need to make more spectrum available to tribes in the future to really shrink the digital divide in Indian country. In the meantime, those like Blackwell will be focused on helping tribes currently in the build-out process succeed. For National Native News, I'm Aaron Bolton.
Native People's Action, Native Movement, and Data for Indigenous Justice are hosting a week-long virtual healing and justice run for Alaska missing and murdered Indigenous women, girls, and Two-Spirit people. The 5K run began Monday to raise awareness and provide a healing activity for the community. Kendra Kloster, Executive Director of Native People's Action, says they're seeking ways to provide a healing space, including through the virtual run.
We've hosted a number of different healing circles, drum circles, and just events to really be together, uplift, and remember, and to be there for each other. During this time, you know, it's not something that we do in person, but we are trying to do different events that we can host online. And right now, we'll be hosting our virtual run, our virtual 5K run for missing and murdered Indigenous women. We also are doing other things like self-defense classes online, just doing a lot of outreach in different ways that we can to really uplift our community.
Participants in the run can share their activities on the event's Facebook page. The run ends on Saturday. Lakota playwright Larissa Fasthorse is among winners of the 2020 MacArthur Genius Awards. Fasthorse is recognized for creating space for Indigenous artists and stories in mainstream theater while countering misrepresentations of Native Americans. The MacArthur Fellowship is a $625,000 grant. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Hundreds of thousands of kids around the country have dyslexia, a learning condition that makes it difficult to read. Lawmakers in the state of Michigan are working on several bills that will help better prepare teachers to understand and help their students. Mary Sherman with the Public News Service brings us that story.
It's estimated that at least 108,000 Michigan children have dyslexia, and there's a new effort to help these students learn how to crack the code and become proficient readers. Four bills were recently introduced in the Michigan Senate to better prepare teachers to understand the characteristics of dyslexia, identify among students, and properly intervene. Third grader Maeve Jansons of Petoskey recently was diagnosed with dyslexia and works with a teacher who understands the disorder. She explains her reading struggles emerged in kindergarten as she felt the words didn't click in her brain.
Lots of my friends were in higher reading groups and I was in a lower one. At that time, I felt like an it'll be a nothing and I couldn't do anything. Now I can read bigger books. It's easier, and I feel like I can do anything.
Michigan is the only state without a statewide strategy to specifically address dyslexia. Ann Arbor Democrat Jeff Irwin sponsored Senate Bill 1173, which calls for the use of a universal screening assessment during grades K through 3 to identify reading difficulties among students. He explains that if dyslexia is detected, the school would provide a multi-tiered system of support.
In the early elementary years, it's especially critical that children learn how to crack the code. If they do not, there are severe academic and psychological ramifications.
It's estimated that about half of third and fourth graders in Michigan are reading and writing below grade level. For four decades, Susan Schmidt of Detroit taught students with learning disabilities. She explains these measures will piggyback existing reading assessments and address the state's overall literacy problem.
This legislation really focuses on the assessments that are taking place, the quality of the assessments. Are they valid and reliable? And do they actually address looking for these difficulties with decoding and being able to do word recognition?
October is National Dyslexia Awareness Month. For Public News Service, I'm Mary Sherman.
Conservation groups are here to remind us that allowing leaves to decompose in your yard is not only easier, it's the environmentally friendly thing to do. Andrea Sears has more.
Conservation groups say one task most homeowners can take off their autumn to-do list is getting rid of all those leaves. Autumn leaves are beautiful on the trees, but most people assume that once they're on the ground, it's time to get out the rake and leaf blower and send them off with the trash. But according to David Mizajewski with the National Wildlife Federation, allowing some or all of those leaves to decompose naturally in a corner of your yard or using them to cover your garden is not only easier, it's the environmentally smart thing to do.
You're going to be doing your plants a favor by providing that natural mulch protection and fertilizing them. At the same time, that leaf litter is really, really important habitat for all sorts of wildlife.
He adds that 33 million tons of leaves and other lawn debris put into plastic bags and sent to landfills every year generate methane, a powerful greenhouse gas, as they decompose. Mizajewski points out that many animals rely on fallen leaves for food, shelter, and nesting material. In fact, some are totally at home, living right there in the leaf pile.
Things like toads or box turtles or salamanders, really, really cool animals, and they can happily coexist with us right in our own yards and gardens if we just give them a little bit of space.
He says many insects, including moth and butterfly caterpillars, also take shelter in leaf piles, providing a major source of food for birds during the winter months. And in the spring, Mizajewski says 96% of backyard birds feed invertebrates to their young, most of which are caterpillars.
You begin to see how all the dots get connected. If you want to see more birds and butterflies in your yard, keeping some of the leaf litter is a really good thing to do.
For more information, look online at nwf.org and just type the word leaves into the search box. For Public News Service, I'm Andrea Sears.
KBOO News poet Dan Raphael has read the writing on the wall.
The pandemic has met its match. It stopped China, crashed the U.S. and world economies, killed over a million people, but it couldn't stop Donnie. Nothing can stop him. Mass protests, global warming, common decency, the will of the American people. He's already one of the elect. What need of an election? When everything's falling apart, no sense in applying band-aids. We need all systems to crumble and burn so America can rise from the ashes. And who better to lead us to this large-scale destruction and chaos than Donnie, the super spreader of them all, not caring if most of those he infects are his staff and supporters. The vaccine is coming to cure us of hope, of democracy. Donnie has slain the viral dragon, our anointed biblical leader, leading us to the promised land of a never-existed America, opening wide the gates to all the apocalyptic horsemen, over-eager to harvest everything they can. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
You are listening to a fall membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Dan Raphael, the producer is Nat Moon, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Lily Bolke, Antonia Gonzalez, Anthony Lizowitz, Mike Moen, Suzanne Potter, Mary Sherman, and Andrea Sears. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 8, it's Juneteenth Radio, reporting on stories happening in African American and Black society. At 10, we'll hear Flashpoints, Investigative Journalism with Dennis Bernstein. At 11, it's Between the Covers, featuring interviews from local and national authors. And at 11:30, tune in for Words and Pictures, featuring a never-before-aired conversation between comics artists. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are made possible by support from our members. We are currently in our fall membership drive, so if you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or use our mobile app and click on donate. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in depth.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Over the past 4+ months, police organizations in Portland have been literally pouring hazardous waste into the city through tear gas, pepper balls, and other toxic munitions. We sat down with friendly expert Dr. Juniper Simonis to try to get a grasp on the effects this unprecedented and abject refusal to respect life in the city of Portland will have on its residents.
My name is Dr. Juniper L. Simonis. I use they, them pronouns, and I am the owner and founder and lead scientist of Dapper Stats, a local ecological quantitative conservation consulting company. I know that before I even finish the word hexachloroethane, most people's eyes just glaze over, understandably so. Chemistry's a long way back in a lot of people's histories, if they even took a chemistry class. And that's actually, I think, one of the insidious things about chemical weapons is a lot of them are named these like ridiculously long names. And so they have these short abbreviations like CS or OC. But the actual like name of the thing is really kind of ridiculous and people it doesn't stick in their brain. And so we tend to refer to these as HC grenades or HC smoke. The particular thing to note about HC is that the purpose of this is like the chemical reaction is to create a munitions style smoke that you can deploy in different places to provide smoke screens for like battleships and whatever. And what comes out of an HC can isn't HC. HC is what goes into the can. What comes out of the can is zinc chloride gas. And so that's the, you know, when we think about the ecological or human health consequences of using HC, we really need to think about, in particular, the impacts of the product, which is predominantly like over 3/4 zinc chloride gas. And this is gas in a like a true sense, like it's gaseous zinc chloride. Zinc chloride in gaseous form presents two sets of problems to human health. One of them associated with the zinc and one of them associated with the chloride. So on the chloride side of things, what happens is that the chloride ions in the air actually end up making gaseous hydrogen chloride, which is like an acid. It's like HCl, but it's in gaseous form. And so the gas is actually acidic, and it causes dermal issues. It causes basically any epithelial cells that it comes in contact with, it will burn. And so that includes your skin, your ears, inside your ear canals. People have reported that inside your nose and your mouth and your lungs and your brachial epithelial cells, as well as your esophageal, like your into your stomach system, like epithelial cells. Everything that's sort of exposed to the environment around it, when you have this level of chlorine coming in, or chloride ions coming in, it actually burns the cells and kills them. And we saw this in people in Portland that were exposed that had novel skin rashes compared to anything else that they had experienced before with any of the other gases. And so the chloride is like particularly gnarly because it destroys cells that it comes in contact with. It's very aggressive in that way. Now, the zinc, on the other hand, zinc is a very, very noxious and deadly gas. It induces what's known as metal fume fever in anybody that works in a space that creates metal fumes, in particular zinc fumes. I happen to be at a hardware store getting materials for doing some science, and was talking to a gentleman who was working there, and when I mentioned that I was dealing with zinc chloride gas, the look of utter terror on his face is still etched in my brain right now. He was like, I used to be a welder. We are taught from day one in welding to stay away from things that are associated with zinc, because that's a heavy metal that you can end up inhaling and it can kill you. And that's true. So zinc and heavy metal poisoning in general can cause a whole bunch of different symptoms depending on where it gets into your body. And this is where the combination of the zinc and the chloride are bad, because the chloride burns things and creates openings for zinc to get into your body. But in general, you tend to ingest or inhale the zinc. If you ingest it, that's where you get a lot of the pretty immediate response of vomiting that a lot of people had. But you can also get delayed responses of vomiting. Symptoms with metal fume fever and zinc poisoning roll out over the course of multiple days. So not all of the symptoms appear right away, and it depends on the person. There's not a standard course of symptomology because it depends on where it gets into your body. And if it gets into your lungs, then it goes into your bloodstream differently than if it gets into your stomach, right? And so where it ends up in your body is going to depend on how it got into your body. And it can impact a whole lot of things because your body is basically trying to clear a toxin. And it will accumulate, but your body can clear it, just not as quickly as it accumulates. And so from the literature that I've read on the kind of human toxicology around zinc poisoning, is that there is often a ramp up and then a ramp down of the symptoms. The ramp up coming with it getting into your body and mobilizing to a spot where the symptoms start to show up. It gets into your brain and you get, it impacts oxygenation to your brain and you have difficulties with memory, or it, it impacts your weight loss or whatever. There are all these different things that kind of happen over time, because your body is trying to get this heavy metal out. The damage that's done to your body while it's working to clear it out, I am not an expert in understanding how much you can recover from that. I just know that your body can clear the zinc out eventually, but I don't know how long-term the impacts of the symptoms that it's created maintain. That's something that's not really my expertise, but from what my friends are telling me, and people are telling me who were exposed to it and are still experiencing symptoms now, is that yes, those symptoms have continued into months afterwards. Now, more than 2 months afterwards.
state and federal laws have strict regulations regarding hazardous waste. And of course, all of these chemicals we're discussing certainly qualify as hazardous waste. Are the local and state governments, as well as police organizations, complying with those regulations?
I 100% know that they are not complying with those regulations at any level, to be quite honest. At the very base level, the leadership doesn't even understand how to handle hazardous waste. They are clearly indicating that they do not understand how to manage hazardous waste, because all of that chemical material is hazardous, and those physical materials that have been in contact with the chemicals are hazardous. And so the only way for them to actually process hazardous waste properly is to collect that and like that all of that residue off of the ground and take it away. And that's particularly relevant, like, important here, because they don't have the other option, which is like watering it off. Legally, that's not allowed because of the types of hazardous waste that we're dealing with that are explicitly detrimental to aquatic ecosystems and are explicitly regulated under clean water regulations are being put into the space like in a, above a stormwater system that drains directly into a river. It's clear that they don't understand the life cycle of hazardous waste once it's put on the ground, and what it means to put chemicals in particular all over impervious surfaces like concrete. There's not even going to be like absorption into the ground. Stuff is just going to like get pushed by water and go into the aquatic ecosystem, where it has the potential to have impacts for generations.
Last time we talked, you spoke about how the police brutality and these toxic chemicals are being used by police organizations to prove how little Black lives matter. And it's fascinating that all of these different bodies, from local governments to national, want us to know that they're willing to go to extreme lengths to show us how little Black lives matter to them.
Yeah, we are willing to salt the earth. They are literally. And literally with the hexachloroethane, like they're throwing zinc chloride. It's gaseous, but it loves water, and water is associated with it, right? So you end up getting chloride ions like you would have in NaCl, right? But it's just VNCl2. And so they're literally salting the earth when they use the HC stuff, and when they use CS, which has chlorines in it, and actually when they use any of the other incendiary devices which have chlorates in it. So yeah, basically they are salting the earth anywhere they go. It's not just that they're using a chemical weapon in a way to disperse a crowd and then cleaning it up, right? Like, the police have this idea that chemical weapons are like regular trash, right? And so the way the general populace in America, because we are so privileged, thinks about trash is that you put it out at the curb and it disappears. So in this particular instance, they think we throw the stuff out there and then maybe we pick up a can because we don't want the protesters to pick it up, and then everything else literally just disappears and like it's not a problem. But the issue is it is a problem, and then they turn it into this thing where they're like, they are intentionally doing it like overboard, because why not, and literally leaving it everywhere. And then the question comes, who's gonna clean it up? And the situation is that the legal responsibility financially for the cleanup of a hazardous waste is the producer of the hazardous waste. By producer, I mean like the one who is producing the waste in the environment, not, I mean, the manufacturer is culpable too in other ways, but like the one who's like the police who are producing this environmental hazard, right? They're the ones who are culpable for cleaning it up financially. And so that money is some money that's going to have to come from somewhere at some point. Who's going to pay for that? The taxpayers, right? Because it's a government agency. The Portland police are going to need to get money from everybody to clean that up because they're the ones who are culpable for it. But in the meantime, the community of civilians is like putting up costs and things to put out time and clean stuff up and try and keep it from getting into the river. It's not, the onus is on the individuals impacted to show that there is an impact. And then it's on the regulatory agencies to hold the producer accountable. And in this particular instance, the regulatory agencies have explicit conflicts of interest because within Portland, we're talking about BES, the Bureau of Environmental Services, who, at least when they create, like when this, all of this is happening before, is overseen by Ted Wheeler, who's the mayor, who also oversees the Portland Police Bureau. So the regulatory agency and the producer are overseen by the same individual. That is also true at the state level, where Kate Brown oversees Oregon State Police and controls the board of the Department of Environmental Quality. And so I have witnessed and testified against during environmental and energy committee meeting of the House of Representatives in Oregon, the complete disregard for the impact of the chemical weapons on the environment and a complete disavowing of any responsibilities for regulatory action. It is painful to me to see regulatory agencies like DEQ and BES abscond on their duties and responsibilities in the face of an environmental and human health catastrophe.
You've been listening to an interview with Dr. Juniper Simonis, Portland's resident scientist and expert on police munitions, among other things. Find more of their work at dapperstats.com.